Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello, and welcome to the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Carla Long, and today you're listening to Percolating on Faith. And of course, our wonderful and amazing guests are Charmaine and Tony Chabal-Smith. Hello.
Hi, Carla. Hi, Carla. Good to be with you.
Wonderful to have you. Thank you so much for coming back. I mean, okay. I just feel so happy that you just show up. Thank you so much for doing that.
You know, it's easy to come back in the virtual world because back is here and there.
And super close to your kitchen. What could be better?
Really close.
Exactly.
Today, you're going to be listening to a subset of Percolating on Faith, and we're talking about Community of Christ theologians, and there are tons of Community of Christ theologians, if you didn't know that. In fact, I am a Community of Christ theologian.
Yes, you're
a Community of Christ theologian.
We all are.
We're all Community of Christ theologians. Now, I don't know if someone's ever going to do a podcast about me. Well, they might. Who knows? Someday. Who knows what the subject will actually be, but... today we're going to talk about two amazing Community of Christ theologians, Marietta Walker and F.M. Smith. Now, I'm going to tell you everything I know about them so far. One, Marietta Walker donated the land for Graceland University.
You did.
F.M. Smith was the son of Joseph Smith III, and the library at Graceland's named after him because he was the first Graceland grad. And
you've been to that library more than most students have.
I loved that library. I had my own little place. It was so perfect and beautiful. And I just loved being there. And that's a little embarrassing to admit about my college years, but we're just going to move on from that.
We want you to be an example for more students, actually.
Yes, we do.
I did have some fun in college, I promise. Anyway, so there's a few things that I know, and I'm assuming that there's a lot more to know about Marietta Walker and F.M. Smith, and I can't wait to start this discussion. So where are we starting? Who should we start with?
I think we're going to start with Marietta Walker for a number of reasons. One is that probably a lot of people would not necessarily put her into the theologian category, and maybe in her own time, she wouldn't have either, though I think given an option, she would. But we're also doing it chronologically. And so Marietta Walker was born in 1834. And actually, she was born while her family was en route from New York State to Far West. So they were already very involved in this new movement that was happening. So she was born on the way to Far West, and she was 5 years old when they were driven out of Far West, and they made the trip then to Nauvoo. So she would, some writers on her talk about her being a playmate to Joseph III. So they would have been roughly in that same time period as children growing up. So, That's a very interesting part, and I'll come back to maybe some of that time in Nauvoo because it was a traumatic time for her and her family, not just because of the death of Joseph Jr. and other leaders of the church. In fact, that's one of her memories as a 10-year-old, her father picking her up so she could see the slain as the bodies were brought back to Nauvoo. So there's all of these things happening. Her family, as Brigham Young is taking over, her family leaves. They leave the church. They go to Pennsylvania. There her father dies, and she and her mom and a brother go to the St. Louis area, where they go to stay with one of her older sisters who lived there and who's married. So you're really getting a sense of the poverty of the time, of how, you know, when there was a death, especially if it was the person, the breadwinner or the property owner, mm-hmm. the family went to another place where their a part of their family was stable, where they could live with them and subsist at least, if not thrive. But while she was there in St. Louis, she goes to a girls' school, and she excels. And the woman there kind of takes her under her wing, and she excels as a student, and she soon becomes an assistant teacher as a pretty young person. And she says, she said of that time, and this is from some writing of her daughter, that this was the first time in her life where she was not identified. The first thing she was identified with was a Mormon. So this was her chance. She was finally being able to separate herself from that part of her family's story. And you get a bit of a sense of why that was so important, because I'm going to go back to their time in Nauvoo. The two of her brothers were tried for murder and hanged in Nauvoo. And writers more than suggest that they were framed. And then another brother was shot, was killed in Nauvoo, just across from the temple, or just across from Brigham Young's house. And so, you know, you can imagine that there was shame involved with all of that. In her daughter's writings, she talks about how in one of the books that Marietta Walker wrote, it was partly autobiographical, but she didn't want to put in too many of the details of her family's story, like her brother's, because she didn't want to be associated with that. She didn't want people to know that she was part of the Hodges family, where that these things had happened to. So,
and if I could add something there, that's a Victorian culture, honor, mm-hmm. shame, right? And the woman especially has to be careful not to do anything or say anything or publish anything that would bring shame to her or the family. So
So even later in her life, she's careful about that. But here she is. She's a young woman and is going to school and is thriving and becomes an assistant teacher. And then she goes on to Oxford College for Women in Ohio and graduates from there in 1859. And just shortly after that, barely graduated. Her sister in Texas dies. She goes down there to help take care of her sister's daughters. And while she's there, the San Antonio Female College needs a principal, a president. And so she takes over that position for a while. And She's 25.
25, yeah, she's super young.
Uh-huh. And so she takes on this role, and, you know, some of the writers, historians say, with the proviso that she could do this until someone more suitable came along. But she was able to step into that role and do that. She married at that point. Her husband died. She had a daughter. And then she moves back to, well, so her husband dies in 62. In 64, she's trying to go back north. This is in the middle of the Civil War. And so she gets back to New York City via Mexico and Havana because she couldn't go overland in the midst of all the fighting.
And a scenic route.
And ends up, actually, when she ends up in New York, it's just after Lincoln's assassination. So she's seeing the cues of people who are lining up to go by his coffin. So you start to think about this time period and all of the upheaval, and she's returning back to be with her family in Sandwich, Illinois. When she gets there, she is, she's outraged because her family are starting to associate with the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
No!
Don't you remember what happened last time we did this? And so she's pretty resistant. She's pretty upset, first of all. And it's her brother-in-law who is who's kind of advocating for the family joining the church. And she does, but it's with a provisionally. There's a little proviso that she has. And so she agrees to be baptized, but this is what she says. I think it's kind of hilarious, but it gives you a sense of who she is. She said, "I will accept your proposition. I will be baptized. And if I receive a testimony of the truthfulness of this work, I will do all in my power to further the interests of the church. But if on the contrary, I do not receive it, I will work just as hard in opposition to it."
She is awesome.
She is
awesome.
And for her, this isn't just about blindly taking on belief, obviously. I mean, she's saying, I'm going to look at this really closely. And she does. I mean, she's pretty soon thereafter, she's involved in, because of her education, her editing skills, her writing, she's part of a committee that's doing the manuscript of the Inspired Version. So,
or as they call it, then the New Translation.
The New Translation, yeah, Joseph's New Translation. So she's very, very involved very quickly. So it's in 65 or 66 that she's baptized, and she's already in 66 then working on the manuscript. And then she made the connections really quickly between belief and action. And I think that's a really important thing to know about kind of the RLDS Community of Christ movement, is that there's always this connecting it to how do you live it out. And so it's in the 1868, so just after 2 years after being on that committee for the Inspired Version, she is at conference, at the General Conference, with a group of women protesting that women don't have voice or vote in the conferences. Yeah. and it's not well received. Let's put it that way. Joseph III did not find this humorous, and they were trying to be, you know, kind of a bit lighthearted about it and just drawing attention to this issue that, you know, women are the ones who are supporting the church. Women are at least probably more than half of the membership of the church, and yet they have no vote. And this is 1868.
Remember,
women don't get the vote in national elections in this country until 1920. So, yes, but Joseph was not amused, and he kind of embarrassed them publicly, and she wrote this
scathing
and sarcastic satire. Yeah, she uses kind of like biblical language to talk about King Joseph and how he, you know, did not look kindly on the requests of the maidens or something. But it was just, she said that. But the really interesting thing is that, and so they left and Joseph, recognizing his error, said, "Oh, you come back." And she said, "No, no, that's fine." But later in that conference, there was legislation put forward to have the vote extended to women in the church. And it was done so with a bit of a proviso that women couldn't initiate legislation, but they could be representative of the different jurisdictions. So even though, you know, it didn't go as smoothly as she might have liked, it did have an impact. And for me, that is a theological expression, is to look at Where is the justice and injustice? Where is room being made to hear God in some new ways?
And neither she nor Joseph III let it affect their relationship, because Joseph III, to him, she was like a theological confidant. They constantly talked theology together. And so he saw her as every bit his equal in terms of that kind of dialogue and discussion. So I think that speaks well of both of them in terms of being able to retain or maintain a good relationship in spite of what happened in 1868.
Right. Yeah. Joseph III said that he valued his chats with her regarding gospel work and intellectual affairs. And then President Fred M. Smith, which, you know, was his son, held her in a high esteem. But there's kind of some fun things going on there, because he grew up in Lamoni, and when she later in her life is in Lamoni, she starts what they called a religio society, which was a debating group. And he was one of the young adults who came, and he was, I think, a little full of himself, perhaps. And sometimes, you know, not well behaved. And so they I think they kind of bumped heads a little bit, but there was, I think, real honest respect there as well. But she had opinions, and she held him to the same rules as everybody else. So it's kind of interesting to see these kinds of ongoing relationships with some other figures in the church that everybody would recognize. But, you know, here she's there shaping Fred M. before he becomes the president of the church by quite a few years. So
Mark Shearer tells this funny story in volume two of his history about Marietta Walker inviting a bunch of youth to her house in Lamoni. And Fred M. is like just over 14, but he's a teenager. Mm-hmm. He's kind of tall, gangly, athletic, and sort of outgoing, but she invites all these kids into her house, and he's trying to step out of the way, and he goes to sit in a small dainty chair, and the chair collapses under his weight, and he just begins to laugh. And I don't know how Marietta felt about it, Mark doesn't say, but the woman who would become Fred M's wife was among the teenagers there, Ruth Lyman Cobb. And so she apparently found him quite charming.
In spite of his lack of grace. But anyhow, so she, you know, she's very involved then in Lamoni. She marries Samuel Fry, turns out he's also a rancher. He's a philosopher. He's a student. He's, you know, he's all of these kinds of things, but he's also a rancher and has a ranch in Nevada. Mm. And so they get married. She becomes a ranch wife, and they have two daughters, and she just throws herself into all of that. And kind of the academic pursuits, she kind of lets go of during that time. It's like these different seasons in her life, and she fully embraces each one. But they were both she and her husband were involved in church work, even there. And then they moved back to Lamoni, and her husband has a large herd of cattle there. They have land, which eventually she donates part of for Graceland College. And, she just is an entrepreneur as well, because, you know, they have this large herd of cattle. Her husband takes care of the cattle, but she is making butter. So this is really high grade butter too. And she's sending it over. She's sending it to Denver. I mean, yeah. She has a contract with somebody in Denver that she's making butter for. And so, but all through her life, you know, she's growing things, or she's creating things, or she's making things to help survive. And, you know, there's no shame in that. This is like all part of what you do. But she's also, you know, intellectual person. And while she was there, once they returned back to Iowa, she pretty quickly becomes the superintendent of the Sunday school, and she starts a magazine for youth and another one for children. And these eventually get taken over, get incorporated into resources by the church. She has the develops the United Daughters of Zion, which is the first church-wide women's group across the church. So, so even though she's in all these roles, she doesn't have an official title, but she's doing things that are the that are needed and that are theologically important to the church. She believes in training children in the faith early and to maintain that throughout their lives. And so that's why the youth magazine and the and in this the midst of this too, and I'm trying to remember what year it is now. Oh, it's in 1888. And she so there's what were called compendiums, and it was like listings of scriptures that prove certain points. So, you know, the beliefs of the church are such and such, and rebaptism. Here's all the scriptural passages that prove that that's required. And so there were a lot of them. Lots of people created these, missionaries and others who did a lot of preaching. And she and Henry Stevens created a compendium. Her name comes first. And so that would indicate, well, quite a number of things, I would say, that she was probably the originator of most of it and probably did a lot of the editorial work as well. So,
and that thing was in print, in print continuously until the 1950s, and then it was kind of re-edited. When I became a member of the church in the 1970s, you could still buy a copy of a later edition of that. So you have a doctrinal textbook that had, you know, about 100 year, not quite, but about 100 year life. So that's pretty big for a text.
So, you know, it's in all of these, when she saw something that needed to be done, or she saw something that needed to be taught, or wanted to help teach things in a more methodical way, then she did. During that time that she, after when she was at the girls' school and then went on to do her education in Texas and all of that before she came back and was rebaptized into the church. She was a Methodist. The school that she taught at was, or that she went to was a Methodist school. And so she had a rich resource of theological understanding that she was drawing from. And you could see, you know, that she wasn't just regurgitating the things that she had learned in the church, but that she was drawing on a much wider understanding of Christianity. And so it's that kind of theology that to some extent we all do, but she really put it to work and she helped other people to have ways of passing it on.
I think you could say that her theological impact on the church was both short-term and long-term. In her time, she's this highly articulate, gifted writer.
And pretty and very well educated for women in that time.
And so she's able to help the church articulate aspects of its faith then within the framework of that time. But then the fact that she is so committed to education that she gives 20 acres of land to the what becomes the larger parcel of land Grayson University is now situated on, that's kind of the long-term impact. And so here, all these years later, Charmaine and I work for a Community of Christ seminary. Originally, when the church first started talking about having a school, they wanted to call it the School of the Prophets. They wanted it to be a school for training
a religious
ministry.
Yeah.
And that's so Grayson developed out of that in 1889 to 1895. And so she was very instrumental in that. And so,
well, and you know, this is another piece. I don't know if you know that she'd been wanting to do this for a long time, but she knew that people would not listen to her. So she figured out who she needed to influence to talk about, because she had suggested the idea many years earlier, and a general conference had agreed that it would be good to have a college to train leaders in the church, but nothing happened. And so then she's starting to figure out, well, okay, so if they have land and they have, you know, some people who are going to help raise some money, Yeah. So she really helped to make it happen, even though, again, she didn't have the official power. She did understand people and the institution and didn't let the narrowness of the day really keep her from sharing what she had to share.
She's very much a late 19th century reorganized Latter-day Saint in terms of her theology. But, you know, and what Charmaine just said, she had a broader vision than that, too. She wrote a book called The Life and Death of Joan of Arc. I mean, here's an educated, thoughtful RLDS lady in the late 1800s, early 1900s, writing a book on a Catholic saint from the Middle Ages. I've got a quote from this book. This is Marietta Walker, and she says this: how soul limiting is the view which sees God's hand only in the narrow horizon of our own homes, our own destiny, our own church. It is a view of the providence, the fatherhood of God, which no true Christian can or ought to entertain, end quote. In other words, God is much bigger than the reorganized church. That's a pretty bold thing to say in the early 1900s, as this very revered figure within the reorganization. She's got a vision of something even bigger. I think that's pretty cool.
Especially when we were banking on the one true church idea. I mean, we were banking on that. That was our thing. Right. I mean, that's a lot of churches' things, of course. But I mean, I have a few things to say. One, it seems like she was the originator of the thought, if you want something done, you got to do it yourself. Like, she just got stuff done. She's like, we need this, I'll get it done. We need this, I'll get it done. She sounds awesome. Moving on to my second thought, I think I would have liked her, but I also think I would have been a little bit scared of her.
Probably. Tony and I were talking about that earlier. It's like, I wonder how easy it would be to be on a committee with her.
Yeah. I mean, she seems a little bit like, if you do not have your ducks in a row, she's going to let you know about it. And she's going to let you know about it in front of everyone.
We decided that Marietta surely always had well-informed opinions and also was quite willing to criticize your uninformed opinions.
But we don't know that for sure.
We don't know that. But she was absolutely revered. And she died during the 1930 General Conference.
Right. But it's even cooler. So her birthday was April the 10th. And this was a General Conference in 1930 that was meeting from like the 8th to the 15th or something like that. And so on the 10th, was her 96th birthday. She was living with her daughter in California at the time. She'd only just moved out there the previous year. Up to that point, she'd been, you know, cooking her own meals and taking care of her own rooms. So she's out in California. It's her 96th birthday. And the conference sends her a birthday greeting on the 10th, her birthday. And there in California, there's a group of like 50 or 60 youth that come to serenade her and wish her a happy birthday on her birthday. So she receives these greetings and then she dies 2 days later. And when it's announced at the conference, the place goes still and everybody stands.
Yeah. All 7,000 people, Mark Scherer notes, all 7,000 people all stood without any prompting, stood. So that's a kind of an intimation of the kind of impact she had on the life of the church. So, yeah.
That brings me to tears. I mean, the very fact that she reached that many people, and she's 96. She was 96. That woman. I mean, God's hand was certainly upon her for sure. That's really awesome. I love that story about her.
And must have been that good butter that she made.
Right? I know. I was thinking butter. I mean, theological impact, awesome, really great. But how good was the butter? Right. I mean, all three of us are butter lovers. Let's
yes,
be honest.
We are. And you know, this is by the time of her death, she's influenced at least 2 and maybe 3 generations of youth and children through the programs and the magazines and the the books that she had created. There's a cohesive women's group. There's a women's column in the Saints Herald. There's organizations with real structured leadership in congregations. And so much of it was due to her saying, this is what's needed. Let's do it. And just very clearly understanding the need and as a good teacher, helping people incorporate it. So,
well, you haven't mentioned this either, but you know, like Fred M. and his brother Israel A., right? And his brother W. Wallace,
right?
They were probably all in her circle, in her globe at some point. And they were the presidents up until like 1978 or something in the church. Yeah. So like, who knows how far her, who knows how far it went.
I mean,
it's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
It's interesting that she didn't have a very high opinion of Fred M.
Well, in some ways. Go ahead. You've got to finish it now.
I mean, Fred M., I think, deeply respects her. Mm-hmm. She found Fred M.'s, I think, style and manner, I'm guessing she found them overbearing and maybe less than spiritual in her mind, because she says somewhere, I think it might be Mark, I'm quoting this from Mark Shearer, but she says that she always imagined the church would be the church triumphant, but not with Fred M. at its leadership, or as its leader.
This is when I would be a little scared of her. I would think that she would like see everyone very, very clearly.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Did I jump ahead there?
No, that was fine. I just wanted you to finish the thought. Because, one of the things he's during that general conference in 1930, at the very end of the conference, there's a memorial service for her here in Independence. Her body was returned to Lamoni. And there's a service going on in Lamoni at the same time as there's a service going on here. And Fred M. spoke at the one here in Independence. And he said, no person has done more for the development of the work of the reorganization than has Marietta Walker.
What an honor.
Yeah. So, but very much, this is a working theology that she is representing. Not one you just hold in your head, though. It better have some substance and some and make sense. And I would say that with her, that it's consistent with the bigger Christian message, the bigger world of Christianity. Yeah. But also let's make this happen. Let's make Zion something we can see and do. And you know, she gave this land to Graceland. But then right on the edge of the land, she also had a small chicken farm that she sustained herself through for a number of years. And so it's like, she wasn't afraid of the hard work, and it wasn't either intellectual or the doing. It all fit together.
Yeah. There's elements of her that remind me of one of my grandmothers who was born in 1897, who went to Central Normal School, which is now Central Michigan University, to become a teacher, but who though she gave up the life of a teacher to marry a farmer, my Grandpa Walworth, she was always sophisticated, well-spoken, well-read, articulate, and in some respects, I think there's I see similarities there. So,
yeah, exactly.
So it's an interesting segue, and I think one of the reasons we pair these two figures is because one of these figures broke Marietta's nice little chair. That's a good reason. But also because they represent a kind of a shift in the theology of the church. Mm-hmm. And if I can use Paul Edwards, years ago wrote a one-volume little history of the church called, I think it's called Our Legacy of Faith. And he, in describing the difference between Joseph III and Fred M., he described Joseph III as an old world man and Fred M. as a new world man. In other words, Joseph III and Marietta, these people grew up in the era of horses and buggies, and most people they knew as farmers. There are not huge factories and assembly lines in their lives. It's a different world, right? In some respects, it's a kind of a pre-modern world. Fred M., on the other hand, as encouraged by his father, grew up highly educated. He comes of age in the world when there's such a thing as Ford Motor Company. And in the world that sadly produces World War I and World War II, but mass mechanization, people moving from the country to the cities to find work in factories, a whole social transformation of the countryside going on. He's highly educated. He was that first graduate of Graceland, mm-hmm. got his Bachelor of Science degree there. He went and did a master's degree. And his view, he in the back of his head, he always knew he was going to become the next leader of the church, though Joseph III gave him lots of freedom to not do that if he didn't want to. But he always knew he was going to need as much education as he could get. And this is a really important theme for Fred M., that everybody's given gifts and your responsibility is to develop them as fully as you possibly can. And for him, that meant education. And he did a PhD at Clark University. He did the work of a PhD in about a year's time. And here's why. His father, Joseph III, is in the last stages of life. Fred M., has said yes to becoming the church's next prophet president. He's going to be ordained at the 1915 conference. His father passes. In the meantime, he and his family have moved out to Massachusetts so he can work on this degree kind of post-haste. And in the meantime, his father grows sicker and sicker and finally passes away. Fred M. and his wife become sick right at the time they should be getting on a train to come to Independence with their daughters for the ordination, and they can't make it. And so, but all this is going, I mean, this is all in this compressed period. And he finishes this PhD with the famous psychologist G. Stanley Hall, right around 1915 or so. And the historians will tell you to get the chance to do a doctor with G. Stanley Hall at Clark University in 1914, 15, 16. This was an absolute plum position. Hall would have seen Fred M. as a prize student to have got him. And so in the midst of the trauma of losing your dad, of you and your family struggling with illness, of you're supposed to be at General Conference to be ordained, but you can't be because you're too sick. The doctor won't let you travel. That's what's going on. But his and then he's got church people are saying, why do you need so much education? And his argument is constantly, God gives us gifts. It's our duty to develop them the best we can. And he figured he knew what it was going to take to lead the church into the 20th century, and that what he had was needed to be developed as much as it could. So that's part of his story. He takes over leadership of the church in 1915 as Dr. Frederick M. Smith. So,
but I think that part of that questioning about why do you need so much education probably came after the fact too, because I think there was a little bit of a bias among some people that, oh, educated people are the ones who are going to cause problems, because Fred M. does shake up the church. He does challenge the way things have been. He does cast a bigger vision of what it means to be the church in the 1920s mm-hmm. and 30s and 40s. And people were not ready for that. They'd had a nice cocoon of being the one true church, as you mentioned earlier, of having that security that you are right with God because you are in the right church and that nothing else is really matters. We have the truth. Why do we need to learn anything new? We already have the whole package. And so when Fred M. does disturb things and challenge people to look at their world in a different way, to get involved in politics, to get involved in things like labor unions mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. standing for the poor. whoa, you know, that's beyond the pale. And so I think it was kind of partly blaming his education for why he was disrupting life, their religious life so much.
Yeah, I mean, he's this very pragmatic thinker, highly principled, but his sense is that what good is a church with all these wonderful ideas if we don't do something to transform society? And that is that idea that the church is supposed exist to transform society is a very new idea in American Christianity that he didn't think up. This is something he inherited from a larger movement going on called the social gospel movement. And, you know, I want to say something about that. And then in a minute, I want to look at a 1924 sermon that Fred M. Smith gave over the radio.
Because this was breaking edge. You know, this is the new way of communicating. And he was right in on it.
I bet he'd give a great podcast, too.
Oh, wouldn't that be great? Oh, man.
We have heard clippings of his voice before, and it's very professorial.
Yes, it's
very professorial.
Formal. So. And
you would be terrified, Carla.
I would probably have to run immediately to the bathroom.
So, you know, to talk about Fred M., I mean, I think the historians will typically want to talk about Fred M.'s transformation of the church and that thing he's known for, supreme directional control, where he takes this church, which is essentially a collection of fiefdoms, right, of 12 apostles, a bishopric, and a presidency. And like, what is that? That's 12, and that's like 14 separate churches. And he's inheriting the leadership of this, and he's basically saying, I can't lead this anywhere. This is not leadable. You need to let me actually lead the church. And of course, the church's memory was terrified of having what they saw as an autocratic leader, because though nobody said it out loud, the memory of Joseph Smith Jr. in Nauvoo was a long shadow over the reorganization. So nobody wanted to have a church with an autocrat. And he's not saying, I want to be an autocrat. He's saying, I want to be president.
But right? He's also saying he really lifts up again the idea of communities making a difference and the idea of gathering. You know, lots of people have been saying, oh, let's, you know, with Joseph Smith III, oh, let's have everyone gather to Lamoni and then to, you know, Independence. And he's saying, no, let's take our time. Let's, you know, and many people really were appreciative of that because they didn't want another Nauvoo with one person as the connector with God, the connector with people, all of that. And so now here's Fred M. saying, yeah, let's do this. Let's have people eventually gathering to Independence, and let's make a difference in our communities, making communities that affect everyone for good. So yeah, there was lots of these little, you know, for some people, warning flags. Oh, you know, here's somebody who thinks different than we do, and where might he take us?
So I think there's an aspect of Fred M.'s theological thought that is not, in my view, it's not lifted up enough, and that's his connection to the social gospel, the Protestant social gospel movement of that period. You actually see phrases from it come out in his writings, and even in the Doctrine and Covenants, where in one of his Doctrine and Covenants sections, he uses the phrase religiously social reforms. Oh, that's like a plum statement right out of the social gospel movement. But before I introduce us to this, I want to say there's an interesting phenomenon you find in reorganization theology in the 20th century up to the 1960s. And I call it the oil and water phenomenon. And what I mean is that you have a figure like Fred M., later you see it in Arthur Oakman and sometimes in F. Henry Edwards. They have this body of reorganization beliefs and practices and self-understandings, this body of one true church doctrine that was in the old preaching charts. They've got that. But then they've been reading, studying, imbibing the theology of generally of the wider Protestant tradition. And they see all kinds of points of contact between that and some of the best stuff in their organization. And so when you're reading their stuff, sometimes what happens is you have, at least for me, I see old reorganization preaching chart theology, oil, And I see like all kinds of early and mid 20th century, really good mainline Protestant theology, water. They did not know how to bring these together. And so what happens in their writings is you see these things side by side. So I'm going to reflect here a few minutes on a sermon of Fred Ems that's highly social gospel. It's like Walter Rauschenbusch through and through. And I'm going to mention Walter here in just a minute. But you can find sermons on either side of this that are like old-fashioned RLDS sermons. So he's got multiple things going on in his head. He doesn't know how to bring them together yet. It's going to take a while for the church to learn how to bring those things together into a new thing. And in order to do that, there has to be some critique of the old, which he's not quite ready, and the church is not quite ready to do yet. So that's the oil and water phenomenon. So social gospel theology, 1870 to 1920, 30, it's a movement in progressive Protestantism, mostly in the United States, though there were precursors in Europe, essentially to take some of the main themes of the Christian tradition, especially related to love and justice, and start to apply them to modern social problems created by industrialization. And so the modern industrial age, the rise of the barons and the monopolies and the trusts that people like
Rockefeller
tried to break. Sorry?
Rockefeller?
That kind of stuff. That's going on at this time. And most Christians, Catholic and Protestant, are still talking about dying and going to heaven. And social issues and problems seem like completely forbidden to talk about. But the social gospel movement arises as essentially Protestant thinkers are beginning to say, the Christian church and the Christian faith are becoming completely irrelevant in this new modern age. And unless we can bring Christianity into some kind of new conversation with modern ideas and with the problems created by industrialization, the real problems that have individual negative effects on people, poverty, illness, prostitution, so unless
unsafe work conditions,
absolutely child labor, stuff like that, you can't just talk about heaven and praying about it and waiting until you die. That doesn't solve these problems. And these problems in the meantime have negative consequences in family and society. You've got to deal with the social problems. And the Christianity these people inherited, they felt like it wasn't up to the task. So they began to rethink Christianity. And the chief alchemist in this movement was Walter Rauschenbusch, a Baptist theologian and pastor. And Rauschenbusch, his books, 1907, Christianity and the Social Crisis. I have an original copy of it here. It's an amazing book. And then at the other end, 1917, A Theology for the Social Gospel. And then he dies in 1918. But Rauschenbusch is kind of like the most influential thinker of this movement. And here's the cool thing. I've got this collection here, Norman Ruoff's collection of the writings of President Frederick M. Smith. This is Volume 1, Theology and Philosophy. And I have this sermon here, 1924, Fred M. Smith, a sermon titled Christianizing Society, right? That is the theme of the whole Protestant social gospel movement. How do we Christianize society? Because you can't talk about regenerating individual lives apart from their social connections. The idea that you can somehow save people and redeem them, but not redeem the social order they're a part of, doesn't make any sense because people are social beings. We're shaped by our societies, right? So that's Rauschenbusch. And so when I read the sermon of Fred Ems, what I find in this, it's like an amazing summary in his own words of this whole book by Walter Rauschenbusch. So I'm going to read just a part of this sermon. This is Fred M. Think of it again. It's 1924. It is the duty of the church to develop and promote this social consciousness and agitate such social reform. To discharge this responsibility, the church must be something more than a Sunday entertainment society, something more than a performer of ceremonies. And now in italics, the pulpit must stand for social reform. denounce selfishness in all its forms, free itself from the charge of being subservient to the interests entrenched behind the bulwarks of self-serving interests. In other words, the church has to stand for social reform, preach it, and free itself from its captivity to the corporations and the moneyed economy that keep it from saying what it really needs to say. It's like, this is 1924. So it is not enough for the church in its efforts to promote Christianity to call on individuals to come to Christ. But the call must be to come with the tools of service in hand, ready to devote time and energy and talents to the common welfare. And so this sermon, it starts off in a way that Reorganites at the time would have liked. It talks about, you know, how society is deteriorating and marriage is under attack and the birth rate is falling. Ah, themes that Rauschenbusch picks up on in that book. But then what he does in the sermon is he makes a switch and says, how can we deal with this? We have to deal with it as a social phenomenon, right? We have to deal with it in terms of the social causes of these things. You can't solve this theologically by telling somebody, just come to Jesus and you'll be all right, right? It's no, the whole society needs to be transformed by Christian principles too. That's social gospel theology. And so it's just amazing to read this and find these quips in here. The church must foster social reform, and its stalwarts may even have to enter politics to accomplish it.
Oh my!
It must stand for social freedom, and this necessitates a break with present conditions. For the church must stand for wealth becoming pervasive and not the heritage of a privileged class. He outlines it in this sermon, the problem of wealth disparity. This is 1924. Listen to this. That there is something wrong with our present system in the matter of wealth distribution is evidenced by the fact that less than 5% of the population in our country own more than 95% of the wealth. This means that to a high degree, the surplus is individualized. In other words, there's all this wealth that's been created. It's been created jointly, but only a few people have it. And they've individualized it. They've made it their wealth when, in fact, it needed to be the society's wealth. And so that surplus wealth beyond what people's basic and decent needs are, that surplus wealth should be, in his words, socialized. By socialized, he means it should be available so that everybody has enough. Everybody can get the education they need as individuals. Everybody can get what they need in order to live the most fully human life, which can then help create a society that is a more, in his words, Zionic society. I mean, this is
preach it, Fred. Preach it.
This is incredible. This is 1924. Here we are, almost 2021, and we have the same kind of wealth disparity, even worse, in the United States, where 1% or less hold like a vast percentage of the wealth, and people are struggling in food lines right now. Fred M. Saw the same thing in 1924, and he says the pulpit needs to preach about that. That's wrong, and it creates sin in individuals' lives. People don't create sin on their own. It's created in terms of the social network we're a part of. I think that's pure and good social gospel theology. Self-serving interests, self-love, these are the things that are behind this massive movement of wealth into the hands of a few. And I'm trying to find this other quote here. See if I can find it, page 150. Yeah, page 150. The gospel has social content. To find and free that social power is or should be the task of the church and the objective or goal of the church. Then he says the prime law of Christianity is the love of God and the love of neighbor. And in other words, the church's task is to live out and to practice, to preach the love of neighbor, and also to see that the love of neighbor becomes part of the social and political conversation, so that we don't have wealth being amassed in the hands of a few, and people's lives being destroyed by powers beyond their individual control. So, I mean, this is pretty radical stuff. And it's interesting, you know, I'm reading through parts of Rauschenbusch today. You don't read this book in an afternoon, but reading through parts of Rauschenbusch today, he has a whole section on the pulpit and the social question. That is, that the church needs to use the pulpit to speak about these social ills and social questions. And he's not talking about, you know, to denounce this person for that or this person for that. That's not what he means. It's the social conditions that have been created by a society that refuses to love neighbor, but allows wealth to be amassed in the hands of a few. Rauschenbusch's The Pulpit has got to speak about that. Right.
And so you can begin to see some of the theological underpinnings of a peace and justice church. Many of these themes, some of them kind of went over a lot of church members' heads, but a lot of them really sank in deeply and helped people in the church see the world in a different way, to see what does it mean? What are Zionic conditions? What could it look like to live in this way that's different from the society around us?
So the social gospel theologians argued that the church exists to serve the kingdom of God, not for its own self, for its own sake. And so I'm sure that Fred M. picked up on that. He picked up on all of Rauschenbusch's kingdom of God talk. The kingdom of God is the goal of the church, not that the church get bigger and better, right? And I'm sure that immediately then connected for Fred M. with Zion and the kingdom of God on earth. The church had some ready-made traditions going back to the early period that easily dovetailed into social gospel talk about the kingdom of God. And, you know, Fred M.'s saying, you know, Christianity has to be about more than getting Jesus in your heart. There has to be, because lots of big businessmen get Jesus in their hearts and then they fleece their workers. And that's not what Christianity is about. So,
and I think, you know, you can see this lived out in that period of the church where as people are gathering in independence, there are also these other elements that are also being developed, influenced primarily by the church, the hospital, being there and available in independence, the social services, different kinds of organizations that initiated from the church, eventually coalesced with other community, the Social Services League and things like that. But many of these things were integrated into the idea of what does it mean to be a gathered community. And so it's, you know, wasn't just, again, talk, but it's like, what does this look like? How do we take care of each other? How do, you know, those who don't have many means still thrive, still be full members of the community and of the church?
So one of Fred M.'s themes in this is the idea that you socialize the surplus. In other words, that the surplus wealth needs to be put to the common good, right? Now, Rauschenbusch has a very similar idea, and Rauschenbusch gives all kinds of examples of how that happens. For example, Rauschenbusch says nobody tries to put out a fire on their own house alone. We have a fire department that is provided for by the common good through taxation. And so Fred M. talks about, you know, socializing the surplus, and the church needs to stand for that. He also recognizes that the only way that's going to happen in some people is through an inner transformation. So he holds together both the social message and the inner transformation that's needed to live it out. And he says that the church is the specialist in this, right? That this is what the church does, and this is what society most needs. Society most needs a group of people committed, whose religious commitments are to the social common good, but who can demonstrate in their own transformed lives that common good is worth joining in for. It's a really profound vision of what church life is about, and my goodness, highly relevant in our own time 100 years later. But if you want to understand where some of the church's justice talk today comes from, it's not recent stuff, right? We have a tradition of social justice talk in the church that Fred M. was very instrumental in helping it enter the church, but it didn't just come from him. It came from Walter Rauschenbusch. It came from the Protestant social gospel movement. And it's something we have resonated with as a church ever since. We have to struggle with, you know, the default setting Christianity in American culture is highly individual and pietistic. It's about me and my relationship with God and nothing else. We have to fight against that. It's not that that's bad. It's just that it has no ultimate goal except me. And so it's highly self-centered. That the social side of that is what the social gospel movement was trying to emphasize. And Fred M. sees them both together and really holds it up. So he's a really fascinating theological thinker. And this aspect of his thought gets overlooked a lot. He's not a perfect person. Fred M's racial attitudes fit the Mid-South of the time. He would not be a paragon there for us.
And even holding these views, he's also more of a nationalist than we probably, most of us, would be comfortable with today. But he's this mix of things, and his sense of vision and purpose of the church causes him to explore and share.
And we should always be worried about presentism, about putting our 21st century values on someone who lived a long time ago.
Right, with all kinds of circumstances we can't even imagine.
But I think it's helpful, though, to realize that when, for example, in our church, when church leaders like the Council of 12 or the Presidency make a public statement on racism or gun violence or something like that, they're doing exactly what Fred M. wanted the church to do. The pulpit is standing for social reform. As we've got to create a society that's safe for everybody, a society in which all people can flourish. That's the kind of social reform that Fred M. was interested in, and it's still the kind of social reform the church is interested in today. So he's certainly a different character from Marietta, though I think there's some shared impulses there, he just has to live in a different world from what Marietta grew up in.
Exactly. So.
It's so interesting. You know, if Marietta's motto was, if you want something done right, you got to do it yourself. I feel like Fred M's motto is, you know, if your church suddenly disappeared, would anybody notice? Right? Something like that, maybe. Yeah. That's just what I've learned today. He seems like such a fascinating man. I might not have liked him very much.
Well, if you were for the things he was for, you would have been really happy. I mean, he was trying to break the church loose from a kind of my language stupor that they had been in, of, you know, navel gazing, if you want to see, but, you know, thinking they were the end all, and he's starting to stretch their view of who they are. And then the next step is he brings in other people into leadership roles who will continue to do that, that will continue to challenge the church to not just be comfortable, but to sense God's call.
Sounds like a good president prophet to me.
One other thing that might be important for us to know, and this is something the historians will have to verify. This is something I heard on the conference floor in 1984, when the World Conference was debating Section 156 on the ordination of women. A man who had been a confidant of Fred M. Smith spoke on the conference floor and said, "Fred M. Smith told me ordination of women would come one day, and it would come by revelation." And that was that was one of those clinching moments in the debate over that section of the Doctrine and Covenants in 1984. But if it's true, if the historians could bear that out, then Fred M. was far-seeing as well. And he saw that some kinds of injustices in the church would be righted eventually. They're never righted fast enough, but he at least could see that it would be.
Oh, that's pretty amazing. That gave me a little few chills. Thank you, Tony, for bringing that up. That's amazing. Well, you know, from learning what I've learned about F.M. Smith, I had, of course, heard about supreme directional control, and he also got the auditorium built, which is a feat. It took a long, long time to get that sucker built. You know, like, there was a lot of things to not like about him, basically, is what I'm saying. But this turns it around, and it shows how far reaching what he really promoted in the church, how far reaching it's gone. I talk about those social justice issues all the time with my congregation. We preach about those social justice issues almost every Sunday from the pulpit in Salt Lake City. And it makes me really proud to know that we come from a long history, over 100 years, yeah, of talking about those things and trying to be a church that is making a difference in the lives of people. Our mission initiative to abolish poverty and end needless suffering. That, I mean, one of the five goals, exactly, if you will, of the church is, mm-hmm, just exactly this.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Yep. So we're anchored. What we are today is anchored very deeply, way far back, 100 years back for sure, and further, of course, but you can definitely see the anchor points, mm-hmm, in Fred M's theological statements.
Yeah, and one of the next people we will talk about, F. Henry Edwards, Frederick Madison Smith is very important in the fact that he had as much influence F. Henry Edwards has as much influence as he did. But then in his own right, he takes some of these themes deeper, and he broadens not only the theological understandings in the church, but also spiritual formation. And he ties those together even in a tighter way. So.
Well, I'm looking forward to that. F. Henry Edwards is a super deep guy. Like, he gets there.
Yes.
And I don't know if he ever quite gets there. It's infinitely deep, but he digs down pretty far.
Yeah. And yet he had this way of communicating that everyone could understand, which was really important.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, you two. This has been really wonderful. Is there anything else about Marietta Walker or F.M. Smith that we should know before we head out?
Well, I just think it's kind of interesting with the Tony ending up with Fred M. talking about women would eventually be ordained, to think about Marietta's influence on him, and you know whether or not that might be part of what influenced him, seeing strong women who were unapologetic about leading.
Yeah.
I wondered that too.
And the only other thing I can add is, be kind to the teenagers. The teenager who breaks your little chair might be the president of the church tomorrow.
You never know. You just never know. Well, thank you so much. You two, you're wonderful, and I really appreciate you. And I have learned so much about both Marietta Walker and F.M. Smith. I really, really appreciate it a lot.
Well,
thank
we're
you.
Glad to do this.
Thanks, Carla.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.